Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and here with me today to talk about directors of double feature past is Michael Kester.
Yeah, I'm here today to talk about that as well.
I don't even know if that's accurate, since one of these directors was not a director last time we talked about him, but let's go with that.
That's fair.
Writers past? That would have been better, I suppose. Writers of double feature past.
There we go. We're doing Clerks, and we're doing Super 8, which brings us back to Kevin Smith and J.J. Abrams, respectively.
And we're going to spoil their movies. We're going to tell you what happens in them, and then you're not going to want to fucking see them anymore, you jerks. Why do you even spoil yourself on these things? God, fucking internet listeners. Anyways, use the chapters, loving listener, and skip over the movie that I'll yell at you for not having seen when we get to the movie that it's in.
Yeah.
Okay, so Clerks is a Kevin Smith movie.
Yes.
And I know we've talked about Kevin Smith twice on this show.
Yeah, once very kindly and once very rudely.
Rudely is exactly how I would say that.
And
in reverse order, probably.
Right. Yeah, we did, what was it? There's Something About Mary. Chasing Amy. That's what it's called. We did Chasing Amy, and we just railed real hard against it. That was back in year one when railing was allowed. That was when thumbs up and thumbs down was still a cool thing to do.
I don't think that was ever cool, but I'll take your
point. Well, it's died out now, and
too soon, too soon.
And then we did Red State, where we really applauded Kevin Smith for his filmmaking. And
yeah,
I went through and I watched pretty much every Kevin Smith movie, with the exception of Jersey Girl, a Kevin Smith movie.
Yeah,
that's the one I didn't watch.
That's a pretty interesting moment in his career, though.
Oh, and I didn't watch Cop Out.
Ah, sure. Well, that's another one, right? That's one of the few films he considers not really his own. And also, he had a bunch of sour dealings with Bruce Willis on that movie.
Sure.
But Jersey Girl was the first that kind of broke out of the original Jersey trilogy or Jersey,
right. I guess the universe.
The four of them at that point or whatever after Dogma.
Yeah.
And it was part of the Ben Affleck, you know, somewhere around J-Lo period.
Right.
That caused a big stir with, his movie at the time. She was in that for a little bit. And then also George Carlin was strangely in that film.
Right. So having gone through, I mean, I saw, you know, I'd seen Clerks 2, but I rewatched Clerks 2. I rewatched Mallrats. I watched Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. Zach and Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't rewatch Chasing Amy. I didn't do that.
Painful memories.
I watched Dogma for the first time.
Sure.
In reality, the majority of his work is really good.
Yeah, and I think you had this opinion prior to Red State too. I know it was really hard to get you to watch that, but we both saw Red State and went, wow, there might be something here.
I rewatched Clerks and I watched it back to back with Clerks 2. And Clerks is really good. Clerks is a really well put together film. I mean, I love the fact that it's so independent, and I love how much of it, like, did you ever catch up on Comic Book Men, that show that he's doing?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you see Walt Flanagan, and that's hilarious just because you know him as a person from Comic Book Men, and you see all this backstory where you find out that Randall is based on Brian, and
yeah,
Dante is Kevin Smith, and you're just watching all this, and suddenly it stops being what I assumed was this pretentious foray into the mundane look at clerk life, and instead it's fucking Kevin Smith going, man, my life sucks, I'm gonna make a movie about it.
Yeah, Kevin Smith whining about his weekends.
Yeah, which in I think anybody's life, you take something with the critical success of The Office, right?
Mm-hmm.
People like to look at how shitty their boring day job is, and they like to go, seriously though, this is hilarious because of how stupid
right.
things can get and how this stuff happens. I mean,
sure.
there are people who go through your cooler and look for the newest milk.
Right.
You know, these people come in and it sucks to be the guy behind the counter, but to be the guy behind the counter that's just washing as a fly on the wall.
Right.
That must be fucking riotous.
Right. Yeah, it's also weird how my relationship with Kevin Smith, especially with this movie, has changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Smith was the first director whose universe I knew.
Right.
I loved that idea of creating a universe and playing in it. And, you know, he had all these movies that had these overlapping tie-ins that made me feel like there were in-jokes, that I was kind of part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the first director names I knew. One of these guys who, like many of the directors I would go on to love, was part of that early independent, you know, every man's filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can do this type of idea. And when I saw Clerks for the first time, that was, I mean, he was our hero, Dante.
Yeah.
He was the everyman when yeah. I was younger.
Sure.
He was the guy who had the shit job and he understood like how crazy the customers sure. were and how mundane and boring and awful and everything you said. And I watch this movie now and look back and I go, God, Dante is so whiny.
Right.
And he's become really the exact opposite.
Right.
It's really, I think I align more with his girlfriend. Just sure. going, God, why don't you do something with your life? Or I don't know that I would tell him to go to school, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Why don't you make some kind of career? The funniest fucking thing he ever says is, you know, you're getting out of school, I'm already in the job market or whatever. Yeah. She says, you work in a market, all right.
Well, and I remember that kind of heavy-handed dialogue being the thing that I initially didn't like about Kevin Smith.
Oh, and man, that, how could you not? That, that's the
well,
that's
like that's the point. Thing is I'm sitting there and they have these conversations that are like, oh my God, two people would never talk like this.
Right.
Two people would never have this depth of a sure. conversation. But that's the point of the film, is that for me, it's this mundane, boring, obvious, clear thing that I've seen and I've been a part of. And I know, you know, the clerk thing. And to take that and then overlay the actual, you overlay this heavy-handed dialogue that is the actual burdening theme to all of that. Because it's one thing to make a movie, you know, of National Lampoon's style comedy mm-hmm. where the dialogue just plays into haha they're waiters and they jizz right, in their customers' right. coffee. That's really sure. funny. It's a whole higher concept to take that base level, yeah, being a clerk sucks, and here's why it sucks.
Right.
Here
right.
is the human struggle to your convenience store clerk. And I understand people don't have this conversation, but that's because no one has this conversation and it needs to be had. And the conversation is not, haha, that lady pulls milk out of the fridge. The conversation is, this isn't a way to be. This isn't right, a life right. to lead.
Sure.
And I really like where that ends up going with Clerks 2, but I think Clerks is such a solid foundation for not only Dante and Randall in this character set, but just an overarching notion for everything Kevin Smith goes on to make.
Mm-hmm.
It's this idea that you don't have to be stuck where you are if you're fucking miserable.
Right.
Even if it's funny.
Yeah, and he manages to make a movie about that just by kind of telling a story of his own life.
Exactly.
It's such a simple, straightforward way to go, well, how do you possibly layer all this together? You go, well, that was kind of my life, so I just lived it and then I put it in the movie. You know, there's definitely two different ways to look at this. There is, as the person who has been a clerk or who sees the absurdity of that kind of job, who whines along with Dante, or there's the person who looks in, fly on the wall style, on the life of a clerk and goes, God, I can't believe people do this, or what, you know, it becomes a almost a documentary style. You didn't know that this kind of life existed, but it does, uncovering right. the dark underbelly of the clerk industry.
Right.
So, I mean, in some ways it is the ultimate bad day movie. It's the ultimate, there's, you know, a shoe shine sign you have to make because someone jammed gum in the locks. The cigarette guy is harassing you, the nicotine gum guy at work.
Right.
I mean, your fucking friend is the most irresponsible person on the planet. And then there's also that looking in as almost characters that could never exist.
Right.
The movie was also a lot more independent than I remember it being when I was younger. I mean, that was another thing.
Yeah.
Seeing this when I was young, I just had no concept of, I mean, I don't remember how much people just totally fumbled at their lines,
mm-hmm.
which gives a lot of, you know, this is the movie I think about when I think we have a bad take, let's keep it in the movie to give a sense of real.
Right.
And that absolutely works in Clerks because they have to do that. I suppose they could cut away or they could splice. I don't know if that's the kind of thing Kevin Smith just didn't want to do or didn't have the time or budget for, or didn't even know how at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't think, you know, let's put an insert here to kind of cover the fumbled line. But this is also, I mean, he's making this on film. As an early director who basically had to max out all his credit cards and finance himself into, you know, way into debt to get this movie made, you only have so many takes of
this. Right.
So that's another thing I think adds to how realistic this is they were showing up and doing a little mini play at this convenience store they worked at, and they were filming them and trying to get a good take and however many takes they thought they could budget.
Sure.
And that was just what they made their movie out of.
Again, to go back to Walt Flanagan,
mm-hmm.
I think he is a really good poster child for the independence of this film. He plays three or four characters.
Right.
Because when you're making a film or you're making anything, your best friends are always your most available friends.
Right.
It doesn't matter how good of, I mean, it doesn't matter if they're a good actor.
Sure.
Because if you have one good friend that's willing to put on a different outfit.
Right.
Four or five different times in a day.
Sure.
I mean, you can get a bulk of work done just because you have this one buddy who's good-hearted enough to fucking cut his hair and put a hat on.
Right.
And come in and drop a different line.
Yeah.
You get this sense that these guys making this movie, they're actually friends. And you can cut a lot of costs just by trying to get everybody equally excited about creating something.
Sure.
And I think that also plays into, you know, it's New Jersey. I have never been to New Jersey, but it is my understanding that there's very little to do. So, you know, you get local New Jersey people who are probably fucking bored.
Yeah.
Looks like it's the New Jersey suburbs, right?
Well, that was Leonardo, right? It's suburbs of Jersey.
Yeah.
And it's almost a small town kind of film.
Yeah.
Everybody's in their 20s. Everybody knows each other.
Yeah.
That plays into the fiction as well as all of these people who kind of did really know each other.
Right, exactly.
You hit on the dialogue too, and I think of everything I look at Clerks for and still recognizing Kevin Smith today, nothing told more about the future of Kevin Smith than the dialogue in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You watch it as part of that independent element where it all runs together, and you mentioned, you know, it feeling really abrasive the first time you'd seen it. And I mean, there isn't a pause in the whole movie. And so when I talk about that as one of the things that I think really makes Clerks, I don't think that's one of the most well done elements of it.
Yeah.
But it's one of the most distinct.
Agreed.
You get one line after another without any, there's not a fucking pause to consider anything in the entire movie.
It is one of the most wonderfully, terribly delivered films in, I mean, I love Dante and I love Randall, but their delivery is horrendous.
Right.
But it's almost like there's so much they're saying, they can't stop.
Well, that's it. Yeah.
You have so much to say and so many big words to deliver.
Yeah. The dialogue was, I mean, it's so much first time filmmaker and it's so much early actors. They're trying to do all of this crazy fucking stuff written for them on paper. And yeah, it's not natural, but that's why I love the movie.
Exactly.
It's jam-packed. How often do you get to see two movies worth of dialogue in one fucking movie?
Sure.
It's a challenge to keep up with it.
Yeah.
It's a fucking mammoth play. You know, I think that's probably one of the nicest things you could say about Kevin Smith's first movie.
Yeah.
It's something that I think he would also recognize as being probably the least polished thing.
Mm-hmm.
It would have to be the least polished thing he's ever done. But he has this style of writing that stands out so much. and having a hard time coming out of people's mouths. To think that Kevin Smith, this is what was natural for him. He mm-hmm. put on the page the best thing he thought he could. And to try and go, how would someone ever read, like you said, these huge words or the amount of stuff they have to say.
This depth of conversation.
Yeah.
How do you have two characters have this depth of conversation while one of them is fucking looking at porno magazines?
Right.
And the other one is stocking eggs.
Sure. Yeah. You're trying to build in their mundane activities and the kind of slacking they're doing and still have them saying all of this stuff.
Right.
I can't even imagine there's any stage direction in a script. Or I think a normal person would look at a Kevin Smith script, somebody who knows script to screen time conversion,
mm-hmm.
and probably say you have a 3.5 hour movie on your hands.
Right.
Even the things that are in the film, I don't know. You know, it's hard for me not to be biased because I saw it at such a young age and I've seen it so many times. But this is probably the most quotable movie in my life.
Yeah.
And part of it comes from having seen it, but I think a large part of it comes from the writing.
Yeah.
I think about the joke all the time. Another group of people only following orders, or what does he say? Hate mongers that were only following orders, the Nazis.
Yeah.
And it's such a, you know, it's become the Nazi fallacy. It's a fucking meme on the internet. Sure. The quickest way to lose an argument is to compare things to Hitler, compare things to Nazis. Kevin Smith was kind of doing a movie of memes before memes were as widespread or popular as they were.
Sure.
Without the internet, I mean, this was, if the internet was only something you and I knew about, we could just go to another planet and make a film, like a Kevin Smith type film.
Sure.
We would take the 10 most popular internet memes and jam them into a movie, and it would feel like that. The conversation about 37 dicks is enough on its own, but then to go in a row is just, I laugh so hard. And then the best part of that whole joke, there's, you know, three fucking punchlines to the joke.
Right.
37 dicks in a row, but the guy from the parking lot is the best fucking part. The, hey, you get back here, what he's shouting at her, you know, out the door. I love the porn titles in front of kids.
Right.
That's another, or in front of the woman and her kid.
Sure.
It's just extremely memorable, kind of safe, but kind of pushing people's buttons.
Right.
There's just something very counterculture about Clerks. There's something very punk rock about it.
Yeah. The thing about Clerks and about a lot of Kevin Smith that I think it simultaneously gets too much and not enough credit for is I think Kevin Smith is known pretty heavily for being a raunchy filmmaker.
Right.
I mean, Clerks has fucking necrophilia.
Sure.
I know Clerks 2 has all that stuff that happens. And Zach and Mary Make a Porno is a film about people making a porn. I mean, he's pushing these sexual boundaries. And I think that a lot of people, I think that when Clerks came out, what was that, 93?
Something like that.
Clerks was the kind of movie that your parents would love if they would just stomach the sex stuff, but they never would. And that's how you knew you were watching something really, really good, because you could watch it and be like, this film is it's sharing good ideas. It's presenting an interesting drama. It's this narrative about something I could totally identify with. And it's saying really deep things. Also, a chick fucks a dead guy.
Right.
And suddenly your parents are, oh, I can't watch this.
Right.
They're saying orgy too many times.
Well, and that's the thing about calling it safe is I feel like that's almost, it feels like an insult to Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
It's not a safe film, but all of the, you know, the dirty stuff is, it's in an area of film that we don't treat like the worst place to put it, but it is. It's the dialogue. It's the ideas. Right. It's the stuff that does seep in your mind. We watch movies all the time where they're using the visual component of filmmaking, one of the strongest components of it, to show us bodies pulled apart and completely fucked up imagery.
Sure.
And, you know, putting us in situations where we feel like we're there and want nothing but to get away.
Mm-hmm.
Clerks uses its visual style, and I think this is true of all Kevin Smith's movies, to make us feel like we're hanging out with friends, we're in a comfortable, relaxed place, and then everybody just has the dirtiest goddamn mouth.
Right.
And so all of the things that would make this movie an R-rated, an NC-17 type movie, are ideas and language. And to think that, you know, if there's any idea that's the worst of all, It's that people would just sit around and talk like this.
Sure.
Which is probably one of the most honest ideas as sure. well.
Right.
It's that thing that says, hey, fucking censor board.
Yeah.
This is how people talk.
Sure.
And they talk in a way that you don't want children to hear. But I also love that Kevin Smith has learned to make film. He's created his own platform. He has empowered himself by going, fuck it, I'm going to make movies. He could now use this power for anything he wanted, good, evil. He could say or do a multitude of things. And he uses it for dick jokes.
Yeah.
It's something about that. I mean, how much more fucking punk rock do you get than I have this powerful medium. People are going to... And you know, he had no idea this many people would see Clerks.
Sure.
But then Mallrats comes out and he kind of knows a lot of people are going to see it.
And then Jay and Silent Bob strikes back. I mean, that all that is that is his biggest... I mean, that movie came out and he was like, everyone's going to want to see this because it's the two characters everybody talks about. So we're just going to make it about... farting and weed.
I know. And that's after an interesting cycle because you look at Chasing Amy and Dogma, much more, I mean, I'll call them serious films, I guess. Sure. Much more serious films. They tackle heavier subject matter.
Exactly.
You know, religion, and then Chasing Amy with the relationship dynamics and just the overall tone of the movie was a lot more serious. And I think that's the point where Kevin Smith kind of goes, wow, I have all this power. Maybe I should say something profound. And after Dogma gets back to, no, I have all this power. I should be making dick jokes.
Right.
And I mean, Kevin Smith's voice has gone on since he's started doing less films and more talks, more stand-up type, just storytelling, which he said is something he's more interested in doing than filmmaking anyways. It's just the medium for him to tell stories.
Uh-huh.
We look back on these films and kind of see, okay, that is the part that Kevin Smith really wanted us to consider. Especially now, I remember when we talked about Ricky Gervais a bit in the beginning, we had to kind of give him credit for fathering podcasting to some degree, or successful monetized podcasting.
Right.
And we can't not mention Kevin Smith in that. You know, he has Smodcast and he has this, it's an entire fucking network of some of the most popular podcasts on the internet. From this guy who basically just wanted to do podcasts before that existed. So he made Clerks, you know, he wanted to do podcasts. So he made Chasing Amy because podcasts didn't fucking exist. I think you look at what he says in Clerks and he's not always right. You know, Clerks is kind of womanizing, if not incredibly juvenile.
Right.
But that wasn't what mattered. What mattered was that he was showing he could do this.
Sure.
That anybody could have this fucking power. And they could use it, you know, when the nerds are reigning supreme like this, they could use their power for a debate about Star Wars.
Right.
That you couldn't get anywhere else.
Right.
That was one of the coolest fucking things when I was younger and watched Clerks is people having these, basically our show, you're a nice show, but about Star Wars.
Right.
It's again, going back to podcasting, you know, if we did Star Wars on the show, we would talk about the contractors and whether or not it was fair that they got killed off.
Sure.
You know, in Return of the Jedi. And we would say, fuck Muppets,
sure.
You know, the end of Empire, blah, blah, blah. I mean, the conversation, Clerks is as much a Star Wars movie as any movie that's ever tried to rip off Star Wars.
Right.
The kind of ideas put forth through Clerks about Star Wars are really pretty incredible. And the jokes it makes, too. You know, Randall's watching Return of the Jedi, but not really. He's watching a bunch of the lamest sound effects ever put on a TV, walks over to Dante. Oh, yeah, I was just watching Return of the Jedi. Using the platform not only for dick jokes, but then also going, I'm going to nerd out. What am I passionate about? What's my cause?
Right.
I don't know. Star Wars? I guess Star Wars, right?
It's possibly the best nerding out of Star Wars ever before Patton Oswalt's little Parks and Rec stint.
I'm so glad you saw that. So very glad. Have you seen the animated one yet?
No.
Somebody animated what his version of the Star Wars movies. If you haven't seen this, quick tangent here. Patton Oswalt did a bit on Parks and Rec where he was filibustering.
Right.
And as a kind of viral ad for it, or what certainly turned into that, they released the entire 8 or 9 minutes of this on the internet so you could just see him go off.
And it's just him speculating about what J.J. Abrams' Star Wars, what is it, Star Wars 7?
7, yeah.
Yeah, Star Wars 7 is going to be.
And somebody actually took all the things he said and kind of animated it. So you see Patton Oswalt, you know, you hear him narrating what is then this animated version of his Star Wars. It's amazing. I will link to it on the site. Hey, speaking of animation really quick and giving me an opportunity to ruin your perfect segue.
Oh, damn.
You ever seen Clerks the cartoon?
I've seen it.
No conversation, no inclusive conversation about Clerks could be concluded without at least mentioning there was a short animated series of Clerks.
Mm-hmm.
Some argue even better than Clerks itself.
Yeah.
Certainly as memorable and notable, I think. Amazing little series of just the original actors from Clerks doing the voices for this fucking cartoon that extends the Clerks mythology before eventually coming around to Clerks 2.
Yeah.
But you're right, Super 8 and the J.J. Abrams. I guess we would say from the writer of John Dahl's Joyride.
Right.
Super 8.
From the producer of Cloverfield.
This is, it's funny, we've covered John Dahl more on our show than J.J. Abrams. I think that probably shows what kind of show we are.
Part of it is because J.J. Abrams always has his hands in the biggest franchise pies in filmdom.
Yeah.
But we just mentioned that he's involved with the new Star Wars now.
Yeah.
And he's already put out two fantastic Star Trek films. Other than that, he's doing Felicity, and he's doing, I'm kidding. He's doing all these television shows. He was responsible for Lost and Fringe, and what was that called? Undercovers? That didn't last.
Alcatraz was one of them.
Right.
Isn't Person of Interest also J.J. Abrams?
He has all these television things that he's just constantly working on, but then he also does all this film work that we never do on Double Feature, because we don't know how to approach something like Star Trek or Star Wars without doing a Spockapalooza or a Lukapalooza or a Yodapalooza or whatever the hell you'd want to fucking call it. So the fact that he finally did a film that is devoid of these massive, massive franchises,
right,
allows us to put something like Super 8 on Double Feature without feeling like we're doing a disservice to Star Trek 1 through 11 or 12.
Right. It depends whether or not you include the Patton Oswalt version, I suppose. Right. And the Wookiee Christmas. The amount of things that have come out since the last time we talked about him, you know, on Joyride, he was just the writer
right.
of that.
Sure.
And at that time, I think it was probably Alias and Lost, maybe Mission Impossible 3.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we knew he was producing Fringe and Cloverfield. But then all the stuff that's come out since then has been even bigger franchises, even bigger than, you know, Mission Impossible. I wonder a lot where J.J. Abrams' star power comes from. And I mean, this is a guy, you know, I will defend Lost probably more than anybody who can at least stand back and look critically on what it's done.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, look how often it comes up on our show.
It's true.
And I will always maintain that some of the moments in the Lost mythology are still perhaps not the greatest ones I've ever seen at this point in my life. But at the time I saw them, nothing just absolutely chilled me like some of the reveals.
Sure. No,
you
I
got
agree.
In there.
I
and
agree.
I probably, again, maybe part of the time of my life or whatever, but I have never spent more time analyzing anything than trying to figure out what was happening in season 2 of Lost, or trying to scrutinize a blast door hatch map.
Uh-huh.
These are things that were not all written by J.J. Abrams, but were from his creative mind.
Sure.
As a point of origin. But then I think about the stuff you've mentioned, and, you know, most of these TV shows, nothing's really lived up to the popularity of Lost. And also, some of these projects have been canceled, even some of the most interesting ones.
Sure.
This is from a writer whose original break into Hollywood was the movie Armageddon.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm interested in, if you ask people to name off five famous directors and they don't know a lot about film, usually J.J. Abrams comes up.
Sure.
What do you think has given him that notoriety?
I think his public persona comes from its a better execution of John Carpenter's public identification. Perfect example. Last year we did a film called Vampires.
Yeah.
On Double Feature.
Right.
If you ask anybody you know, if they've seen Vampires, first off, they're not even going to realize you're talking about a film. Secondly, you're going to have to be more specific.
Yeah.
Because the film, by every means and title, is going by John Carpenter's Vampires,
mm-hmm.
which is what you get J.J. Abrams Star Trek. J.J. Abrams presents Star Trek, a film by J.J. Abrams.
Right.
The thing that I think J.J. Abrams has as an edge is that by being so deeply involved with television, which is an incredibly strong medium now,
yeah,
almost rivaling Hollywood in right. most aspects, to have your name pop up weekly on 6 different TV shows.
Yeah, sure.
The general public, when they see J.J. Abrams is directing Star Trek,
yeah,
they go, oh, J.J. Abrams, I know that name. I don't remember how, but it's intrinsically built into my mind because yeah. I watch Person of Interest and I watched Lost and I watch Fringe. And so 3 times a week, I see J.J. Abrams' name and I don't even realize it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't think about that, but the kind of saturation you get from that. I mean, I think about, you know, when Quentin Tarantino had 2 or 3 movies, he was a huge fucking name.
Sure.
People knew nothing about him, but he had just made Pulp Fiction. And so then you knew about Reservoir Dogs. And suddenly he's making all these little tiny projects that are in the works, but not quite coming out. And it's not really since those days of Tarantino that I can think about somebody who's, I mean, I don't want to say done so little, because Abrams is a really fucking busy guy.
Sure.
But to be a producer on most of these shows,
yeah,
not to have a single project that I go, oh, J.J. Abrams, he is the Lost guy.
Right.
He's the guy who came in, dropped the idea for Lost,
sure,
filmed the pilot, and then took off.
Yeah, J.J. Abrams, I think, is a bigger name than a player.
Yeah.
But that's not taking away from how good his work is.
Well, because I also think as a producer, when we see Quentin Tarantino movies, they're very small capsules. The movies themselves are generally pretty long. But, you know, you want to know everything there is to know about Pulp Fiction, you watch Pulp Fiction.
Right.
That is not true of J.J. Abrams. J.J. Abrams has created as many universes as he has properties.
Right.
You know, it's not just Lost. It's Lost and Lost the viral campaign. And Lost the video game, and you know, Lost the mini-sodes or
right.
cell phone-sodes or whatever the fuck those were called. And you know, you get really deep into Lost and you start talking about, you know, Rachel fucking Blake. I mean, it gets
sure.
There's a whole universe out there that people watch the show don't even know about.
Right.
That's the same for Fringe. That's the same for, well, Star Trek, obviously, and Star Wars existed long before him, but are perfect properties given that he is dealing in a phenomenally large franchise with a lot of moving pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And even something like Cloverfield has all of this viral mystery surrounding it, and the advertising campaign was really unique. We talked about that when we discussed Cloverfield. And so he comes in as somebody who, I mean, on a lot of these projects, I don't think he even can direct because he's moving around so many large pieces at once.
Sure.
You might not have time to do it.
Right.
Super 8's a great example because you and I are talking about it, as you mentioned, since it's, you know, the scope of it seems to be easier.
Right.
Because it's not a giant franchise with all this backlog we have to understand.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the kind of thing where Super 8 versus Star Trek, to really love the Star Trek films, I mean, you will love them even more if you're a Star Trek fan. Super 8, you don't need to bring anything to the table.
Right.
From start to finish, the story is self-contained. Now, granted, it's supposed to be a massive nod to the old Steven Spielberg E.T.-style sci-fi, and it's supposed to be kind of like a Goonies bent.
Right.
But it's not necessary to love the film, because the difference between it being part of a universe and it being kind of a reference is that Steven Spielberg films in the 80s were wonderful. They were good. And so all this film really has to do to pay any sort of homage to Steven Spielberg in the 80s is be good.
But you also remember the trailers and stuff when this was coming out,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. And everybody was saying it's Cloverfield 2.
That's the crazy thing is this is J.J. Abrams trying to do a one-off, simple, just perfect, neat little film and then put it out there and people have it, but can't quite get away from that world building. He's just drawn to it. You know, it's part of his obsession with mystery and with mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an enigmatic trailer that comes out. Nobody knows what it's for. It's a new secret J.J. Abrams project. What's it going to be about? And then you see the trailer and you still don't know what the fuck the movie's about. Is there an alien thing or what's going on?
There's a box.
And then, of course, again, viral campaign.
Yeah.
You know, so we have this alternate reality game people are playing and they're pulling together clues and trying to edit stuff. The thing that they edit together ends up showing up in the movie as the found test footage.
Uh-huh.
So still creating a giant world around it, something that does not detract at all from people who just show up and watch it like a Steven Spielberg 80s film. But for the people who really geek out on the J.J. Abrams stuff, all of that is there in the background, right, too.
And so, finally, we get to Super 8,
mm-hmm.
which is, it's a sci-fi movie as much as it's a little kid's, it's a children's movie.
Right.
You deal with the a lot of the themes of, you know, a mother who was killed in the small town, somebody dying in a small town, that affects everybody's perspective of you.
Right.
If your mother dies, everybody in town is going to treat you differently.
Yeah.
Plus, if your father's a police officer and he's not been there and he knows the man responsible for the death of your mother,
right,
that just adds this definite gravity to it. And then you try to have the, you know, the Kevin Smith style, bunch of friends just want to make a movie.
Yeah.
And you add that in.
Is it wrong of me to like that as, you know, my favorite piece of the...
Oh, no. I think that it's great. And I think that...
God, I love that.
I think that that adds so much to moving the story along, because J.J. Abrams is definitely one of those people who, when you ask, well, why is this and how can you justify such and such, he's really good at filling in those holes.
Yeah.
And with a film like Super 8, you go, well, how do we get this kid to this spot? Without, he happened to be riding his bike and he took a wrong turn.
Sure.
So you go, they're making a movie and the kid, the director of the film is really, really bent on production value. So
right.
When there is a military investigation, we get there, we dress up like the military people, we film in front of it. So that's how we get the kid.
What a smart idea.
That's how we get the child.
Just on all fronts.
Yeah. That's how we get the child to a military investigation, and that's why the kids are out at night at a train station when there is the single most spectacular crash ever made in a film. And I don't say that with any qualm about, oh, maybe I haven't seen it, or oh, maybe I'm forgetting what. I saw Super 8 in the theater the week it came out, and that train crash in a theater... I shit you not, there was not one person by the end of that 25-minute train wreck. Every single person had their fingers in their ears, and they were all kind of crunched up, you know, trying to get away from the spectacular destruction and the loud noise and these children running from falling flaming boxes. And, you know, you have one train car that gets stuck up against another one, and then the fucking gas tank car shoots up off of it. And you're sitting there going, this is the thing that I fear every time I see a train. Right. For me, whenever I see the train cars that are carrying volatile fuel,
right,
the first thing I go is, man, if that fell over, that would blow up. And so when this train is wrecking and you have people filming and children running around, I mean, this is one of the most spectacular moments. And it's so early on that you just know this film is going to be doing these wide, huge moves.
Yeah.
And you start getting children, you know, stuck in buried holes with alien machinery.
Sure. I mean,
the film does everything you could possibly expect in a sci-fi movie. It's just as big of a scope and it's just as expansive of a viewing experience as the Star Trek movies. And as I'm sure Star Wars will be, and as everything J.J. Abrams has ever handled, is it has the understanding of spectacle that Lost did, and that all these J.J. Abrams properties always do.
Sure.
Which is the first thing I fear when I see J.J. Abrams is doing a small town kids movie about aliens.
Right, right.
So he goes, no, fuck that. Watch this train wreck.
Yeah, sure. Spectacle is a really good word for it. And it's, you know, to have all of the explosive, spectacular aesthetic of a giant space battle, but just in wrecking a train.
Right.
It's something you wish you could just, you know, will it to be more often. To go, I want to take the guy who made this particular explosive battle scene, and I want to see him apply it to something. I don't want to say mundane, like the train wreck is.
Sure.
A train wreck is pretty catastrophic.
But compared to a lot of the other stuff we've seen him do,
yeah,
it's sure. just a train wreck.
Yeah, it seems like such a simple little, the Earth is not exploding in two. It's just going to be, you're right, it's just a little train wreck. There's no alternate dimensions, time rifts, battleships appearing and disappearing into space. I mean, this is, it's just a train wreck. And then to see, well, I want to know what a train wreck looks like when J.J. Abrams does it.
Right.
I mean, that's how you fucking get a name. You go, yeah. This isn't just a train wreck. It's J.J. Abrams, a train wreck.
Right.
And the scene is spectacular enough on its own. It plays like fucking Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
You know, it's ridiculous that the fire hail raining from the sky and just, oh my God. And the fact there's some unknown alien element to it that you're not even getting yet. We don't even need to play that card yet. But then the context of this is also in a bunch of children making a little independent film.
Right.
So if you just want to boost it up just one more notch, you go, can we just show some really amateur filmmakers right before I do this?
Yeah.
Right before, you know, it's what act do you want to follow?
Sure.
And you just go, well, let's find the most basic, simple, don't even really know how to make a film act. And then I'll show you J.J. Abrams' train crash.
Yeah.
It's what you don't want your film to go before in the independent circuit. Watching these kids make this film, though, is so great.
Oh, it's so funny.
It's like just watching them playing a game. You know, they make it look so easy.
Mm-hmm.
Every time he cries out production value, I mean, I just feel like that's...
Sure.
It's the best. It's really when filmmakers who create film for a living are making these giant blockbusters, they're just playing like children.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of how the public imagines it. But I think to a large degree, I always think about Jeremy Kasdan when that comes up. You know, when he would describe to us in these conversations we would have about filmmaking and what it was like, and we've never really done it on the scope that he has. So, you know, we were interested in this, and to hear his stories, and he's running around like a madman with a camera with a bunch of, you know, suicide girls he's managed to convince to be in his films and trying to get these different shots so that he can make it all in editing. And then watching their quiet little performance on that stage going, God, is this girl going to be any good? And only knowing what the other actors were doing in their little zombie movies and stuff. And then everybody being pretty blown away by her performance.
Right.
You get impressed by this quiet little performance, and then you get blown away by the fucking train. You forget that, oh yeah, this is pretty good for all these little kids. And they're like, oh shit, J.J. Abrams made this movie.
I've gushed about the train wreck because it's no secret that is possibly the most memorable thing about the movie for me. But then you get the whole sci-fi aspect and the kids running around because they see the benevolence of this creature and they're not sure that this needs to be going on. And kids are always willing to be in a bad spot because they don't realize the gravity of a situation like this. And so you have this military shooting some beast and you know, your friends are getting kidnapped, so you have to go save them. They come face to face with this huge monster. And you get that quintessential children sci-fi moment where the one kid who ought to be a little bit weaker than this steps up and goes, you don't need to be afraid. You know, he steps up and the alien uncovers his eyelids. And we get this human moment that can only be achieved by the innocence of a child. And that moment in a lesser filmmaker, I would be, yeah, okay, yeah, I know this is what you do in a sci-fi movie with children.
Sure.
But J.J. Abrams makes it so honest, and these kids are so concerned with, you know, their friendship, and this town is broken, and they're all each other has.
Yeah.
Them and the druggy store clerk who will drive them. I love the drugs are so bad moment.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And that, again, is followed by one of the most spectacular moments of the alien's spaceship and launch module being created from those little the little cubes.
Yeah, right.
And that whole moment where the military's guns are being pulled away. And every time there's a big spectacle, but it's always prefaced by this innocent, honest moment of childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And you're left wondering, well, yeah, that was kind of badass. But you know what was also badass was that kid standing up to that alien.
Sure. There's definitely an element of this, especially with the filmmaking aspect, where I just can't help but imagine J.J. Abrams is, you know, thinking about what would impress his younger self.
Sure.
Or if only he could see that. Going back to that time of his growing up with a lot of these Spielberg movies.
Exactly.
I mean, I feel bad even talking about Spielberg on this show, because there is this kind of forced comparison. I worry all the time on our show about falling into a narrative that exists.
Uh-huh.
And when this movie came out, and everybody, especially trying to figure out what the fuck was this.
Sure.
As soon as they saw Spielberg's name attached to it, they would come out of the movie and they would kind of go, well, yeah, it's like J.J. Abrams doing one of them Spielberg things.
Yeah.
But I mean, at the same time, that is...
That's the nod.
It's kind of an inevitable comparison, right? Right. I mean, this is E.T.
Yeah.
This is J.J. Abrams' take on a classic Spielberg film.
Yeah. And he said that. I mean, he said that when this film was coming out, that Spielberg inspired him as a filmmaker, and this is his way of, you know, really doing that inspiration the justice he wished he could do.
Yeah, right.
Plus, you're right. It's totally that, and then also set back in the time period where J.J. Abrams was the little chubby kid,
sure,
searching for sure production value.
Those kids, the fact they used all, you know, unknown kids and had these talent auditions and stuff, and it's great just seeing the bunch of people that came up and not recognizing any of the faces.
Right.
You know, just having it be a bunch of fucking kids. I think what's really interesting to me to look at then, outside of that narrative, is, okay, what is Abrams doing differently than those Spielberg movies? How does his take on that look different? And while the similarities are some of the greatest parts of the movies and certainly the most iconic parts, little things like, you know, like showing the case,
yeah,
in the credits,
mm-hmm,
that just felt to me, watching the case at the end is always going to be my favorite part of Super 8.
Right.
It's always going to be, well, I have to finish this movie no matter where I'm catching it at the particular moment it's on, because
mm-hmm,
I really want to watch the case.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of these new ideas of cinema we've got as Spielberg got popular and as everybody started emulating Spielberg. You know, if you just told me, well, we're going to see another filmmaker's take on Spielberg, I would tell you, go to the movies, you know, any week of the year, and you'll find somebody giving, yeah, their take on Spielberg.
Sure.
But to see Abrams do it, little inclusions like the case,
mm-hmm,
or the overall enigma of the world of J.J. Abrams, I think are what make this movie a little extra special.
I agree.
DoubleFeatureShow.com is the website. DoubleFeatureShow@gmail.com is the email address. And the executive producers on today's show were Flint Ironstag, Maxwell Harley, Meta Somerville, and the great Hannah Hughes. We have two movies we're going to do next time on the show as well.
I'm going to highlight some great social rebels.
Yeah.
So we're going to do Bartleby, and that's the 2001 version of Herman Melville's book, Bartleby the Scrivener.
Sure.
We're going to pair that up with America's classic Bad Boy. And we're going to do Rebel Without a Cause.
Do I have to do some reading homework for this week's double feature?
Never, because that's a different podcast and that's a different nap time. So watch more fucking film.
Bye.